Good evening. My name is Alana Putza, and I'm a program director at the Legatum Institute, and we are so very glad you can join us this evening for this great discussion in this fabulous venue. And before I hand it over to our distinguished panel, I just wanted to say a few words about the Legatum Institute and why we're putting together this program. We are a public policy think tank based in London, and we do research and publications and events that explore the foundations of prosperity. That means looking at why some countries flourish or some societies flourish and why others fall into decline. And we think that the answer to this is multifaceted, that the usual economic and political indicators are important, but it's also important to look at the whole picture. So, you know, what are the roots of innovation? What triggers curiosity? What triggers imagination? What creates a community? And how does one participate in that community? And we think that when looking at the answers, they're not straightforward, but certainly history, arts, culture play an important role in that. So when we put together our wish list for global fellows, we really wanted to bring in someone who could really speak to the cultural aspects of prosperity. Dorothy Kaczynski was at the very top of our list, and we're thrilled that she agreed, and she has written this very thoughtful paper, which will be the basis of our discussion tonight, but also please do take a copy on your way out there at the front. Dorothy Kaczynski is a very good friend of the Legatum Institute. She was a professor at our cross-disciplinary summer school. She also served as a panelist on a global leaders forum we had in DC last year. She's, of course, the director of the Phillips Collection, which is why we are here in this great venue this evening. She's an art historian and has, over the decades, curated several wonderful exhibits in the Dallas Museum of Art and also in several cities in Europe as well. We also are thrilled that President Stephen Knapp has joined our panel tonight. He's president of George Washington University since 2007, and an expert in literature, romanticism in particular, and literary theory, and also served on the Commission for Humanities and Social Sciences last year. The report came out, and it really drew attention to the vital role that the humanities play in addressing several of our modern day challenges and also preparing this country for the future. So I'm sure some of those themes will come up in our discussion this evening. And leading the discussion is our chairperson, the wonderful Jeffrey Brown of PBS, correspondent for arts, culture, and society at PBS NewsHour, and also the creator and host of the Arts Beat, the cultural blog at PBS. So I'd like to thank all of our panelists for being here and look forward to what I'm sure will be a very, very exciting discussion. And Jeffrey, over to you.
Thank you very much. First thing, turn on the microphone. Can everybody hear me?
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you, Alana, and thank you, Dorothy, for having me and hosting me, and thank you, Steve, for joining us. Dorothy and I have talked over the years about me coming to do some things here, and this was the first one, and when she sent me the title, The Importance of Culture, well, that's all I needed to see, really, because that's a subject that is near and dear to my heart, both personally and professionally, just to establish my own credentials, I guess, as a humanities guy, because I want that to be clear. That's what I am. That's what I was in college myself. My undergraduate degree is in the classics. I studied ancient Greek, so you beat that, right, for humanities. I have tried to remain that, personally speaking, and then professionally, it's extremely important to me, and maybe we'll get this into the discussion, but as someone who does the daily news, which you know what that means all the news of the day, national and international, but it's extremely important to me to think about how culture fits into that. and to make a place for that in a daily news program, and to think about culture as part of, yes, what's going on in our world, what's happening. So we should know about it, and we should hear from our artists and writers as our cultural newsmakers of the day. So that's why this was important to me. Just to tell you how we're going to do this, I'm going to ask Dorothy to talk a little bit about her key points and themes and maybe how she approached this. We'll ask Steve for a short response on that just to get this started. And then the three of us will talk for a little bit, and then we will open it up for all of you. Okay? So, Dorothy, you can tell us a little bit about how you approached this and what you were after.
Thank you. Appreciate you all being here today and participating. So it was easy to say yes to this assignment to write this paper, not because I don't have a rather demanding day job, but because it gave me an opportunity to gather up thoughts, concerns, issues that stimulate my thinking. I was about to say plague me on a daily basis. And we were together, you with a much more substantial role, and my contribution was as a moderator at a major conference just down the road at Johns Hopkins SAIS 2 years ago on this very subject. I've been invited to give keynote addresses at universities and talking there and there. And now I'm serving at the invitation of President Obama on the Humanities Council. So it's just the urgency for me to take the time to put this in order, for as close as I got to order, was very compelling. So my apology at the beginning was I'm using carelessly, but with great awareness of that lack of care, interchangeably words like humanities, arts, and culture. I mean, it's how many pages in this paper? I mean, let's not mince words. And I also very distinctly am approaching any of these issues from the perspective of an art historian, a curator of many decades activity, and now the leader of a international cultural institution in our nation's capital. So, and I have to say, I do tend to do this, don't I? I tend to interrupt myself with my own footnotes, but I'll try not to. It enriches the experience, I assure you.
We will be the decider of that. But do go on.
I just came back from an art museum directors conference, and it was one of the best conferences. Aren't most often really not very compelling, and this was, and it was all about these issues. There's not a museum in this country that isn't grappling with these issues. So basically, because some of you have read this thing, and some of you might, and might I entice you perhaps to do so, there are two aspects of what I wrote about. One was to present a kind of palette of arguments about the importance of culture, humanities, and arts in a prosperous society. I've just stole that from the Legatum Institute. And basically, some fundamental arguments and some instrumental arguments. I love reading somebody like Martha Nussbaum, who wants to talk about how arts and culture promote empathy and understanding in a democratic society. That's hard to not like. This notion of empathizing with the other. So one of her anecdotal, heartthrob stories was about, she's from Chicago, her experience with the Chicago Children's Choir, this idea of bringing together kids from any race, religion, economic context, and not just bringing them together, but it's hard to create that sense of cooperation, of actually learning to sing something together. So that idea of participation, creativity, so one of the fundamental arguments. And sort of an expansion thereon, the idea of that participation of creating an arena for discourse in what I would say even more urgently in a fragmented society. And then the instrumental arguments, and they are legion, and that's probably what plagues me constantly. You know, we're concerned about the impact on the quality of education. Some of you may have read Crystal Bridges, Alice Walton's new museum in Arkansas. They collaborated with the University of Arkansas to do a longitudinal scientific study of the impact of just one visit of the school kids. We have a different philosophy here. It goes deep and long, and that's a footnote. But this idea of impact on learning, quality of education, Alana mentioned innovation and creativity. I mean, in a way, go back to José Ortega y Gasset when he says it's the poet invents what's non-existent. This whole idea that the arts gives you a platform for innovative thinking that otherwise you may not tap into. But then there's the economy. American Federation for the Arts, they'll tell you how many jobs are produced, about the tourist dollars, et cetera, et cetera. I'm interested, because I'm married to an architect, and I like cities, urbanistic impact, how arts organizations are anchors for neighborhoods, how they promote civic pride, redevelopment. Think P and 14th Street. Whole Foods and Studio Theater, from what I've been told, were the catalyst for a breathtaking change. Global impact, soft diplomacy. We had our adventure this year by being invited by the State Department to send one of our educators to Lahore and Islamabad to bring our arts integration methodology to about 350 emerging artists, students, kids, orphans. I guess this is compelling to me because it's what we do here. It's no longer acceptable to be, what was the phrase in my strategic plan, to be the sleeping beauty. You have to have an impact. You have to prove the impact. You have to be not just relevant, you have to be needed. So the other side of my, and I'm almost done, don't worry, the other side of my discussion was framing, and we talked about this a lot at the Art Museum Directors Conference, that it's a moment of crisis. The head of the Doris Duke Foundation, he said, well, maybe what's happening, at least in the visual arts, it's like the Reformation, pounding the theses on the church door. We don't want you to do it for us. Tell us what is important. We want to do it ourselves. Everybody's a professional amateur. They want to curate. They want you to give them the information, and they're going to take it and be creators themselves. Huge shift in, I mean, as a curator, you know, you think you know what you're doing. You like to do it, and you like people to enjoy it. Blank, blank. You know, now that it's impossible to maintain that stance with any credibility because the accessibility to information, the demand for participation is so emphatic. Not to mention, this is where plagued on a daily basis, financial pressures. This place has always, it's had the noble collection, situation in the city, and international reputations, never had the financial footing. But now I think that the sources of funding have changed, have dried up. There's major shifts in philanthropy that match the huge shifts of wealth in our society generally. Audiences are aging. So whether you're a symphony or a museum, that really has an impact on your business model. You know, who's coming? How many people? Does that help your bottom line at any point? Demands of the new generation. Of course, I think of my daughter. You know, access, participation, transparency. That's been part of the museums that I have worked in for the last 30-something years. In 1992, the AAM, what was its title then? I wish people wouldn't change titles. It flummoxes me. Produced Excellence and Equity, and it was basically... No. It is no longer really acceptable to preserve, protect, and display. It's about your audience. It's about education. It's about bringing something of meaning and significance to your community, and that's only gotten ratcheted up. Here, we talk about service to community, collaboration, proof of impact, doing good. And then technology. You know, it's at the speed of light. It surpasses, every time we redo our website, oh my God, we're redoing our website. We were among the first museums in the country to have an app. The speed, the velocity, it outstrips your budget, your imagination, your capacity. But on the other hand, we're doing a You Curate project with the next show, meaning you can play, you can redo the exhibit on your mobile device. What about Wikipedians in residence? I mean, that's like letting the Huns in through the door. But it's fascinating because it's more knowledge. It's confidence in your authority, not a sort of cagey fear. So, I'm almost done.
You said that already.
I know. I knew you were going to say that. So, we get sidetracked, however. The culture wars, like, whose beauty? Is that beautiful? Is that my canon of taste? Probably not really a very helpful way of approaching the arts. Rather, arts are disruptive. They're there to make you think. They're to challenge you. They're there to maybe give us a key to discussing the disharmony that seems to dominate his nightly news. We also fall victim to zero-sum approaches to life. It's kind of like, look at Detroit. It's art or pensions. It's STEM or STEAM, as though science and humanities were at odds. I think your writers of the classics would disagree. I prefer something, I've sort of fell in love with this word and idea, Edward O. Wilson's, this biologist's notion of consilience. I love this illusion, maybe, but you seek to grasp the wholeness of our intellectual and cultural endeavor. Maybe, and here I will end, but remind me later to talk about Monuments Men and Vaclav Havel. But for me, the sort of touchstone, because we like to live up to Duncan Phillips, who was an internationalist, who was a risk taker, who talked about in the 20s, what are you doing here, Mr. Phillips? It's an intimate museum combined with the experiment station. Gift to me, I have to say thank you, Duncan. But, and he wanted people to come in here and the encounter, the authentic encounter with the work of art would allow them to see as artists see. That sort of says it all. Anyway.
Well, so Steve Pick, Dorothy says there isn't a museum in the country that isn't grappling with these issues. Right. There's not a university in the country that isn't dealing with these issues as well, correct?
That's right. I may actually say a little bit about this commission, the Humanities and Social Science Commission of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. I was one of more than 50 people who participated in producing that report that was published this past year, and I think many of the topics that were touched on in the work of that commission over several years were actually very similar to the things that Dorothy, I think, so eloquently and effectively highlights in this paper, which, if you haven't had a chance to read it, it's available in sort of pamphlet form here, and I hope you will, because it really is a nice survey of the debates that are underway. For example, debates between those who are, like Martha Nussbaum, who are rather bullish on the moral values that are inherent in engaging the humanities, versus others like the philosopher Naumas and others who are a little more skeptical about the immediate translation. I have to say, I'm among those who have written somewhat more skeptically about the immediate translation of aesthetic values into moral and political values, and so there is that divide. But she really does hit all the bases that were covered in this report, whether it's the role of technology, this kind of participatory culture that's developing around us because of technology and the Wikipedia effect, and certainly the challenges in the reduction of public funding, which are in some ways have been even more dramatic when you look at overall reductions in funding for public higher education than they have been even for the arts and humanities taken in isolation. Think about this commission, though, and it produced a report called The Heart of the Matter, which I think was not a bad title. It's very much, nevertheless, the work of a committee. The way these deliberations proceeded was you'd have 50 people in a room, all of them very accomplished leaders of industry as well as of the arts and of academia, scholars, university administrators, and so on. And the way these conversations proceed is each person gets up and informs all the other people in the room of what they've forgotten, ignored, neglected, and that now needs to be filled in. The result of that is no matter how carefully you try to focus these kinds of exercises, you end up having an inventory of all the best practices there are, all the perspectives there are, and it's very difficult to focus that into a powerful argument to an audience that's going to make a difference to the support for the arts, the funding of the arts, the sorting out of this conundrum that we have, the paradox between the need for expert guidance on the one hand and unleashing all the energies of the communities that surround us and that can engage with works directly through through the internet. By the way, I have to say, I do want to thank the Legatum Institute and also the Phillips itself for giving us the privilege of having this conversation in a room that's where we're surrounded by so many masterworks of Western painting, at least, and it's a reminder of what this is all about. But how do you identify the audience that's going to make a difference, and how do you actually address that audience? The audience, I suppose, for the commission's work was Congress. Well, so what happened? A number of us went to Congress and delivered this report. I ended up testifying, as among others, in front of congressional committees that were going to have some effect on the funding. When the omnibus bill came out on January 16th, the result was that there was no increase in the funding of either the National Endowment for the Arts or the National Endowment for the Humanities over their pre-sequester levels. They both came in at $146 million. We had asked for an increase to $154 million. That didn't go anywhere. Did we prevent a cut from occurring? We certainly didn't create an increase in public investment, but how important is that public investment when it's at such a low rate to begin with? That's less than 0.5% of what the federal government invests in scientific and medical research. So I'll just close by saying where I see the real action happening is in collaboration among arts and humanities institutions themselves. And that's where we're really putting our efforts. I mean, I think the advocacy efforts are great. I think the exploration that's going on in multiple media is great. But I think where we really are seeing some traction in this effort to bring the arts and humanities to the kind of level of public awareness and effectiveness that we all are interested in is in establishing collaboration sort of across the sectors of the arts and education. And one example of that I can say very close to home is the partnership that the George Washington University has established with the Phillips Collection, where we're sharing speakers, where we're engaging students in a collaborative effort. We're launching just this spring a partnership with, actually the first several plays will be coming out, in a partnership with the Arena Stage, in which our university is partnering with the Arena Stage to produce three plays on the Civil War as part of the sesquicentennial remembrance of the Civil War, but also focused on not just the American Civil War, but civil wars around the world. And we persuaded other institutions to get involved in this as well. So Harvard's having a similar partnership with ART in Boston, Emory University with Alliance Stage in Atlanta, and the University of Maryland College Park will be partnering with Center Stage in Baltimore. We'll produce a total of 12 professional plays, and in our case, 10 student plays, and each one of those will involve a collaboration between a student playwright and a scholar in some other field, whether it's history, nursing, medicine, whatever it might be, that has some bearing on the Civil War. And I think that kind of activity, sort of proving the concept that the arts and humanities have a lot to contribute together, and also combining that with technology in ways that are also, one of the things we're doing is we're creating a museum on our campus that will bring the textile museum from Colorama down onto into the heart of our campus. But alongside that, we're building, actually out on our Virginia Science and Technology campus, a 22,000 square foot state-of-the-art conservation center, which will connect the work of the museum with our students in engineering and other technological fields. So I really see the intersections among these enterprises as the kind of activity we ought to all be concentrating on. And I'm beginning to feel that the advocacy efforts, they need to proceed, but they're not really getting the traction by themselves that we've hoped for decades now.
All right, well, let's pick up on some of those themes and issues that you brought up. But before we do, let me throw one more institution on the table here. Mine, public broadcasting.
Yes.
Everything we've talked about, and I couldn't help it as I was reading through your paper, everything that Dorothy talked about for museums, everything Steve talked about for universities, of course, applies for public broadcasting. I just wrote questions as I was going along. Who are we? What is our purpose? What is our role in fostering democracy in a diverse society? How do we see our mission vis-a-vis the individual citizen versus the community? How do we serve local communities and also a national sense of community? How do we justify seeking public funds? How do we confront new technology, free exchange of ideas, changing business models? How must we change? Do we have a future? All these things apply to all three of the institutions that we're talking about, and many others, by the way. So the first thing I want to ask you, is it even odd that we have to sit here and discuss the importance of culture in a prosperous society? I mean, why are we doing that? What is the problem? And when you use the word crisis, I think, is it a crisis? Do you see us in a crisis?
Maybe that's a little bit of hyperbole, but I do think that cultural institutions, I think a huge research university like GW is more robust and perhaps more resilient than an institution like the Phillips. We'll be celebrating 100th anniversary in 2021. You know, the respect, the sense of the scholarship and the new knowledge, and I think one has... You just cannot take for granted the consensus, I think, around values. And I think sometimes we fall into a trap that articulating need versus articulating importance. And right now there's so much need across the society. I mean, you fall into a trap of comparing things of different importance. I do think that the sense of not being the sleeping beauty, of feeling that you really are deliberate and eloquent and robust, almost aggressive in making the case, because it's not about advocacy. I agree with you, Steve. But of just doing it, of just the kind of partnerships that we've forged with GW and any number of theaters and dance troupes and students and elderly centers, it transforms our work from something insular into something dynamic and impactful in our society.
But there is a sense, is there not, in both all our institutions, that you have to make a case for yourself more than you did in the past? Do you feel that?
It depends on who you're making the case to. I mean, you know, in our case, we have so many different audiences in the university, mm-hmm. that it's almost it's rather mind-boggling. I mean, it's not just the students we're trying to attract. It's the parents of our current students. It's potential philanthropists. It's neighbors in our community who want to know why we're there and what we're contributing to their lives and the quality of their lives. It's obviously members of Congress and so on. But I think to try to focus that, I mean, the complexity of our product is as broad as the complexity of the audiences that we're trying to reach out to. And I think that's equally true for the arts as it is for the humanities, and it's certainly true for higher education as a whole. You know, when you look at the times when the American public has been persuaded to invest in a large, concerted way in institutions like ours. I can think of sort of three cases in my lifetime where that was evident. Actually, one of them preceded my lifetime. That was the GI Bill, when we had to absorb millions of service personnel returning to civilian life, and there was a huge investment in creating the education system that we enjoy today and that really is responsible for the middle class that everyone is now trying to shore up and to preserve. But there isn't yet any longer the impetus for making the kind of investment, because we see this tremendous defunding, particularly of public institutions of higher education, which is that is a crisis, by the way. I mean, whatever we think about is going on with universities in general and museums, to get between a 25% and a 75% reduction of state funding for public institutions, which do almost 3/4 of the teaching of higher education in our country, that's a huge challenge, I think, for us to maintain the educational system, which did come out of, among other things, the GI Bill. The second was the Sputnik challenge, which resulted in a huge investment in science, which had tremendous spillover effects in the humanities as well, in the teaching of foreign languages and so on, that all came out of the sense of defensive competition that we needed to engage in, particularly with the Soviet Union. And the third was, there really was a successful advocacy effort a few years back in doubling the budget of the NIH for medical research. And that's if that was a case of a concerted advocacy campaign that really paid off in a major investment. Not at the level of the first two I mentioned, it was certainly not as dramatic as those. But we've had decade after decade of advocating for increased public investment in the arts and in the humanities, and it hasn't really paid off. And I think what we really need to focus on is what we can do, not waiting for that the restoration of that particular model of patronage, which may not come back in our lifetime.
You don't think it's going to come back?
I don't see evidence of it coming back, to be perfectly honest with you. I think we can make these compelling arguments for the role of the humanities innovation. I can't tell you how many times I've heard the story from Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs about how, you know, he got his design ideas from taking a Reed College course in Chinese calligraphy. But I don't see a rush for federal investment in courses in Chinese calligraphy. Right. And as a result of that, and of course you could point to multiple counterexamples of people who never took a calligraphy course in their lives and did perfectly well in generating technologies. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough case to make in a compelling way as a public case, but we all think there's something to it. We all think there's something to the notion that exposing engineers to the humanities will be good for them. But you can't boil that down to the kind of argument that's going to say, if you're trying to make we can't even get the American public right now to support in a concerted way investment in our train tracks.
Yeah.
How are we going to get them to invest in our humanities and arts
but that,
program?
But that, no evidence it's, of it. But that it's good for you goes back to where the arguments you were working through in your paper. Because it's good for you, you want to say to students to take these classes.
Yep.
It's good for you professors to teach them. It's good for you parents to pay for it. It's good for you, you know, people off the street to come into this museum. But what does good for you mean? That's what you were looking at in different ways.
Well, we talked earlier today, Alana and I, about sense of quality of life. And maybe going back to my fascination with urbanistic issues, there's a reason why a city like Washington is having this wonderful rejuvenation. And it's linked, I think, to a nascent suspicion about that quality of life involves maybe less independence, more involvement in a community. And it sounds so simple to say access to public transportation, you know, the north exit of the DuPont Circle metro, or to having restaurants and walkable sidewalks and an arts organization. But I think that those are very meaningful life experiences that people, if they're allowed that opportunity, can develop concepts around. And I think that's a little bit amorphous, what I just said, but that it's good for you sounds so moralistic, and that's really not what I mean. Actually, it's just the contrary, you know, art isn't there like castor oil. Why does that date me? It's there because it can delight you. It's there to do something that few other things. So this advocacy, it's good for you. It's really not what I was hoping to say. It's more that, you know, to see beautifully as artists see. That's a dimension of life that we should all be lucky to have, and it does not come at the cost of the pension plan. I mean, this idea that the DIA is going to be the Detroit Institute of Arts has become the whipping post of the bankruptcy proceedings, and that you're going to solve the economic problems by selling half a dozen paintings. I mean, you know that's not going to solve that city's problems. It's simply a distraction from more fundamental problem-solving analysis, urbanistic engagement. I just have to do this. What you talked about, the real crisis is in public education. That is what you said.
Well, I was actually talking about public higher education.
Higher education. Yeah. Well, I would say, especially from the standpoint of a museum, You know, when I started at the Guggenheim Museum as an intern back in the 70s or something, you know, there wasn't a development department, but that's another issue. But there wasn't an education department because it just burgeoned into, it transformed the whole landscape of what a museum is and who works there and what we do. And the reason that happened is basically museums jumped into the breach left by our willingness as a society to abandon our public education. Yeah. I would say not just arts education, because our methodology here is not to teach you to be an artist. It's to teach the teacher, give him or her the confidence to use arts to teach writing and history and social studies and math well. So I think that this notion of crisis, it's not about art is good for you. It's about, like, are we really educating our future? Not about, you know, knowing who Ingres is, but learning to think in a certain way. And I don't know, it's not an advocacy plea, and it's a good for you plea. It's simply like, we just abandon. I mean, I grew up in a working class household, and my education was what gave me my life. I took it really seriously, and I would like other people to have that opportunity.
I mean, it's funny because when you put it, that's very a simple way and a clear way of putting it. When you walk through the arguments in your paper, and, you know, there's the ethical, there's the good citizenship argument, there's what you were calling the instrumental arguments, right, which I'm very familiar with because I get bombarded with these papers all the time, too. Art is good for you because it creates jobs. Is that enough of a reason? Well, that's a good reason in an economy, a bad economy. Art is good for you because it makes us better citizens. Is that the reason? Well, that's a good reason because we're all citizens and we want to vote. But you're just putting it as simply as, well, it's a good thing to be exposed to in some sense. It's hard to define.
Well, actually, what I said was it's existential. Uh-huh. What I said was not that it's good to be exposed to, but it was a existentially transformative element of my life, and I'm not alone. No. So, you know, I guess Alana needed a paper, so
let me suggest another way of thinking about the point that I think that Dorothy is making, which is that instead of thinking of, you know, a lot of the arguments, the instrumental arguments, which are perfectly fine. I mean, all these arguments are, you know, mutually compatible. It's not, and I think you say this explicitly at one point, that the intrinsic arguments, you say, Dorothy, at one point, for the value of art are not at odds with the instrumental arguments. You can have both those arguments. It's just that they don't add up to a case that's going to persuade people in a large-scale way to do anything about it, in our experience over now, as I say, multiple decades. And part of the problem here is thinking of the arts as a means to prosperity rather than think of the arts as the definition of prosperity. So I think what I would like to say to kind of focus what the existential point that Dorothy was just making is, what people have to participate to the point where they see their participation in the arts and in the humanities as an essential element of what prosperity means to them, so that they're committed to it in such a profound way that it's something they don't want to lose. Not that they're persuaded that it's something they should invest in because it'll have another kind of benefit, it'll make their children better students, or it'll improve the design of Apple technology or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. Not that those are bad things, but if people don't see it as an essential part of their lives, an essential part of what it means to be prosperous, you're never going to succeed, I don't think, in selling them on the idea that it's essential to prosperity. And so that shift will not take place through argumentation. It's going to take place through production and through participation and engagement, the kinds of things that we are seeing happening between museums and educational institutions and neighborhoods, frankly. It's the reason I happen to be on the board of the National Symphony Orchestra. It's the reason the National Symphony Orchestra is now going out into neighborhoods and is, in fact, generating a good deal of excitement in doing that. That's a small-scale instance and almost a kind of pilot just a slice of what's possible. Whereas I think if we can actually mobilize these institutions, that's why I think collaboration is so essential. It's only if we can mobilize a large-scale engagement across multiple sectors that people will see the arts as inseparable from their very notion of what it means to be a prosperous community. And then they're not going to want to lose it, and then they're going to be willing to see it invested in.
So what kind of specific, what do you see as the way forward for this institution, for example, but for other museums generally? What kind of specific to play to that, to partnerships or between the private and public sector or for this institution?
Well, I mean, I totally agree about the central, urgent importance of collaborations, sort of within your community and beyond. I mean, our community, because we're surrounded by embassies, we've made cultural diplomacy, and that sounds, you know, that sounds very Washington, and I don't mean it to sound that way, but it would be very stupid of us to not exploit the collaborative potential that's at our threshold. Hence the collaboration with Pakistan, with the Georgetown School of Foreign Service. I mean, the list goes on and on. So it positions this museum to be more than a much beloved small museum of modern art, America's first museum of modern art. It positions us to have a big public intellectual impact because we're dealing with the faculty and the students of several major universities. We're dealing with embassies. We're dealing with the State Department. There's that notion of transforming what a museum means in people's lives. What is the capacity? Also, I think we think about like our fundamental core projects differently now. Just for instance, an exhibition that we're organizing that will be here in Jerusalem and in Sao Paulo. And it's about, I mean, it sounds obscure, but actually it's so compelling. It's Man Ray, the American photographer and painter, and the mathematical object. And these are the weirdest kind of esoteric paintings, but it's not really what's delightful about this show. It's an artist who fell in love with these found objects at the Mathematical Institute in Paris, and he became obsessed with these bizarre, surrealist found objects that were made to teach math students abstract thinking and equations. So an artist falls in love with a math object, and then he makes paintings of these, and he gives them Shakespearean titles. If that doesn't, like, break down the walls between STEM and STEAM and get your mind going. So for us, it's a perfect kind of, it sounds like it's thematic, but what it is to grab onto a theme that is like on a silver platter to allow us to talk to our teachers and students, the community, the public, about how there is that consilience, there is that intermeshing of our intellectual, artistic, real life input.
Well, we'll open it to questions for a minute, but can you pick, do you see a way forward for our society to get past these kinds of STEM versus STEAM or this versus that, the black and white?
You know, in debates about education, for example, the president just Thursday before last called together 85 university and college presidents to talk about opening access to lower income students and their families to higher education. Huge challenge that we're facing right now because we've seen an increasing disparity, which is not unrelated to the disparity in income, disparity of wealth, which I do, and if we want to talk about crisis, that I see is a crisis in our society. Mm-hmm. How what we're talking about can play a role in that kind of outreach to students to get them engaged in the kinds of activities that we think are going to lead them into, you know, a middle-class future and so on and begin to close that gap. Is there a way to pull that off? It's difficult to say because whenever you have these strategic discussions, what you find is, again, an endless list of best practices. You know, you walk away from one of these symposia with a sense that there's an infinite number of best practices. Well, that doesn't help really focus a public effort. I'm putting the emphasis, I think, very much on really exemplifying, instantiating these efforts, doing exactly the kind of thing that Dorothy was just talking about. It's not talking about how these different things fit together. It's actually making them fit together. It's proving the concept by enacting it. It's by actually having these collaborations, going out, you know, breaking down the boundaries between secondary schools and higher education, also breaking down the boundaries between the dwindling number of, and maybe some of them are being restored, but basically arts education classes that most of us who have an interest in museums today had the privilege and the pleasure of going through when we were children. which in many cases don't exist because of, you know, the current theory of how K through 12 education is supposed to be designed. But we can overcome that, I think, by exemplifying those connections, actually going out there into the schools, bringing the people onto our campuses, bringing them into the museums. This is something we're all doing. I'd like to see more focus on that action and less anxiety about making the argument that's going to finally get people to vote for the arts, because I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. Fair enough. I want to thank you both, Dorothy and Steve,
thank you.
And thank you all.